the World Wide Web was invented at CERN by Tim Berners-Lee. Mm-hmm. And it was for, you know, scientists to exchange information and so on. And so I was invited to CERN to give a keynote there at the first World Wide Web conference. Mm-hmm. And there were two keynotes, my keynote and Tim Berners-Lee.
Welcome to the Encrypted Podcast, your gateway to the future of technology and innovation, right here in the heart of Dubai's dynamic tech universe. I'm your host, Maria Vovchok, and together with Dubai Blockchain Center, we are embarking on a journey that unravels the minds of tech visionaries through the digital frontiers that are shaping our world. Hello and welcome everyone to the Encrypted Podcast. I'm your host, Maria Vovchok, and today we're really happy to have here David Chaum, a well-known computer scientist, a pioneer in cryptography and privacy-preserving technologies, and a widely recognized as an inventor of digital cash, godfather of cryptocurrency, as they call him. David is currently leading XX Network. It's a completely private, quantum-secure, decentralized messaging and payment platform. He's also known for other fundamental innovations in cryptography, including privacy technologies such as MixNets and secure voting systems. He's also known for having a PhD in computer science from Berkeley. He has taught at New York Radio School of Business and the University of California. David is the founder of the International Association for Cryptologic Research, the cryptography group at the Center for Mathematics and Computer Science in Amsterdam. And he's the founder of DigiCash, as I mentioned earlier, among breakthrough projects and our digital blind signatures, multi-party computation and random sample voting. So many things, David. Yeah. What else probably our audience should know about you that probably I haven't mentioned so far?
Oh, well, first, Maria, let me thank you. So, we talked about doing this podcast
for a very long time,
and I'm really glad we were able to sit down together now. It's a great pleasure.
And likewise.
Thank you. I'm looking at a lot of, I've got a lot of different ideas and projects sort of underway, but I'm so I founded the XX Network,
yes,
but it's running autonomously now through this foundation. And I have really tried to double down and focus on my new technique, which is a new thing, which is called Better Than Money.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like really intriguing, I would say so. Like, what is right now better than money in this world?
Well, actually, it took me a while to recognize this, but money is a bad deal for the poor because the poor hold money in order to buy things, to do transactions, but it is always becoming worth less and less,
mm-hmm,
whereas richer people...
Are you talking about, in this case, about cash specifically?
Yeah. Money in a lot of countries, it's getting worth less and less very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
That's not very fun. Sometimes commercial banks, go bankrupt. If there's a run on the bank and then you're left with nothing. In any event, it's not a way that you can invest,
mm-hmm,
and hope to make more, create a larger value and get ahead. So you're just always kind of living hand to mouth if you're poor with money, because you have to hold money to buy food, but it always keeps slipping away.
Mm-hmm.
So money is I like to say it's a screw deal for the poor. It's not a good deal. It's not what you want. And actually, it would be better for everyone on the planet if we got rid of money and the poor instead invested in different kinds of assets, and that would then have a lot of benefits.
So you're in this case, in other words, what you're trying to say that you want to make this gap between those who have bigger income and those who have like very low income. You believe that one of the major issues is the, in this case,
the kind of money, the whole money, the way that that transfers of value are conducted. I really do.
Okay, so that's very interesting. But how do you believe, like, if we eliminate cash and let's say money as a notion, what can be like used instead?
Sure.
And how can we bridge this gap potentially?
Well, so I worked on it for about a year because I really hard because I recognized that the poor are really being harmed by money, and what they need is a better way to transfer value. And so what I've developed is better than called Better Than Money.
Okay.
And it is a way that anyone can keep all of their value in an asset portfolio. So they have to allocate it between different asset types. Think of like the 1100 ETFs that BlackRock offers. There's a lot of different types of assets that are available today. And, you know, AI could help you decide how to do that, or you might copy someone else's portfolio. But anyway, so you keep all your value, even if you only have $100, keep it in assets and that are hopefully like Apple stock and Bitcoin, and, you know, you're starting to make a little bit of money, increase in value. And then when you have to transfer value to someone to buy something, you can transfer value out from your portfolio of assets directly into the portfolio of your counterparty.
So in this case, when you're talking about like this, when you mentioned about BlackRock ETF, it's one of their products.
Yes.
When you're talking about Better Than Money system, let's in this case break it down. What kind of assets or what kind of products are we talking about?
Well, so Larry Fink, founder,
and very important. This is not investment advice because we are here at the podcast. We are definitely talking about technology, but we're not like saying in any way where to invest or where like to put your money.
But good point. Yeah, but I just want to say historically, about 20 years ago, almost exactly, Larry Fink founded created the idea of an ETF, an exchange traded fund.
Yeah.
Specifically in order to allow, let's say, the middle class to have access to investing in all the kinds of things that rich people could invest in. And the middle class was not able to. So the exchange-traded fund was an idea that Larry Fink had at BlackRock, to his company, to, you know, do well by doing good. Because he wanted to expose the broader public to some of these more unusual types of investments. And so those include all kinds of things like, you know, index metals, any kind of commodities, currencies, you name it. There, right now, I think BlackRock has over 1,100 ETFs, and altogether globally, there's about 10,000 ETFs. They're not only issued by U.S. companies. There's about $10 trillion under management. That's 10% of global assets under management. And so it's it grew like crazy. And it's very well understood. And the idea is that, you know, as the owner of an ETF, you really have a claim against the underlying asset. So they have a legal structure developed for this custody. So this is, you know, these are the kind of assets that people should really think about investing. There's something there for everyone. And an AI can help you choose the right ones for you. You know, it depends on, say, how old you are, you know, and, you know, how whether you're more risk or less risk averse. You know, some people have relatives or residences or, you know, involved in more than one country. So then you have to take that into account. You know, your business might involve baking bread, so you need to know about the price of wheat and energy to run the ovens. You know, you so major corporations never want to hold cash. They want to invest in things that help them hedge against the kinds of exposure they might have and help them make money. So, you know, so what I'm proposing, in essence, is to take the whole financial system we have today and use technology just to turn it.
Dubai, home for innovations. Bit in history back, because sure. You were the one who back in 1982 you applied cryptography to cash. So this is how and 30 years ago you sent your first online transaction.
Yes.
So do you remember how it happened? Because actually it kind of spurred a lot of teachings and a lot of in this case movement that yes. which later on led to, let's say, developments in cryptography, which later on led to crypto, which
yeah.
is like the new as well option for a lot of people to use.
Yeah, but it's better than money's gonna take okay. over. But let's come back to
okay,
that.
Okay, let's
want to
debate
answer your
about
question.
That.
No, yes. no, we don't debate it. It's the,
no, no,
it's
I'm really
clear
curious,
to me.
Like, to know,
but that will happen. But let's roll
options,
the cameras back to yeah. you know, 40 years ago. I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley,
uh-huh.
and there was a new head for the National Security Agency, the secret code agency of the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
He said, anyone that talks about cryptography at a conference or organizes a conference, a session, we're going to throw the book at them.
Why?
Because cryptography was considered by it to be a like
weapon.
A military, yeah, that like time. A national security issue, just like nuclear weapons. They felt, because if you design a nuclear bomb in your basement in the United States, it's born classified. The government considers it to be a state secret, mm-hmm. even though you didn't base it on their information.
Mm-hmm.
Same with cryptography. He said, cryptography is born classified. Can't talk about it in a public forum. You can't organize a forum. And if you do, we're going to just throw the whole book at you. So, you know, I had realized how fundamentally important cryptography would be in the information age, you know, which I saw coming even back then. And mm-hmm. it's the only way to really protect the individual. So mm-hmm. I basically just organized a conference on cryptography.
Oh, when was it? When
this
was
1982.
One?
I risked spending my whole life in jail to set cryptography uh-huh. free. And one of the papers I gave there was about electronic money, a way to have privacy protected money, e-cash.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, yes.
And that 10 years later, well, I guess it was maybe more like 12 years later, but whatever, in the mid 90s, I made the first eCash payment, and that was, so I do remember it exactly, and it's because I have also seen a video, I have a video of it.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you remember that the World Wide Web was invented at CERN by Tim Berners-Lee,
mm-hmm.
and it was for, you know, scientists to exchange information and so on, and so I was invited to CERN to give a keynote there at the first World Wide Web conference.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two keynotes, my keynote and Tim Berners-Lee. And mine was first.
Amazing.
Yeah, and what I did in that keynote was I made the first e-cash payment internationally. So I paid from CERN to Amsterdam. And, you know, it took a lot to do in those days. They had this giant projector so they could show my computer screen to the audience. Normally, you know, we used to work with slides in those
yeah.
days. But this was a digital, and I could show that me actually using the eCash app and make the payments. And, you know, later in the day, I went out to the patio at the cafeteria there, because it's like a 24/7, you know, scientific lab, sort of kind of grungy, and, you know, people are eating all different hours there because they're there all the time. And so I'm sitting out there on the patio, my laptop, which, you know, in those days, a little heavier duty than laptops today. And I made like a short press release about it, mm-hmm. you know, like three or four paragraphs, sent it to my kind of amateur part-time PR guy who worked for our company doing all kinds of odd jobs, Paul Dennison. And he, I don't know, sent it out to some people. Next thing I know, it's in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, everywhere. I was like, I was on TV in 12 different languages that I don't even know where, you know, it was like, I was at a, you know, grocery store, an elevator, people said, well, you're the, you know,
yeah.
It was a big deal. People were just fascinated by the idea that a number could be worth money. That was my invention, and it had the privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so Yeah, I remember that, pretty clearly. And you know, in those days, I used to wear suits and I had a lot more
hair.
You're
still wearing a suit.
No, like in a real, jacket. Like a full with the ties and everything. And I looked a little better in a suit.
you look nice today.
You're
as
very
well.
Kind. Yeah.
So, by the way, talking about eCash, because electronic cash application that aims to preserve a user's anonymity, and at that time you inventing many cryptographic protocols like blind signature that
yes.
you did, mixed networks, and the Dynamic cryptography protocols.
That's true. Yes.
All of these things were invented thanks to you.
I invented them, those things, and this kind of inspired the cypherpunk movement because mm-hmm. it meant that. You know, you could do all the things that are needed in society while still maintaining your anonymity, your privacy, control over your own information. So it was very influential. And, you mentioned the mixed networks.
Yes.
Yeah. And so that's turned out now to be a really interesting and important thing because the original eCash, which I demonstrated, mm-hmm. It had this sort of famous list of spent coins
yeah.
to prevent you from spending the coin twice,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you get the coins are blind signed by the bank, and then you unblind them and you can spend them. They can't take the money from you and you can spend it, and they don't know it was you. And this, Deutsche Bank issued it, and we issued it at Cyberbox. There's a whole eCash museum. You can see it on my website. Yeah,
uh-huh.
A lot of stuff about that. But now, this guy I know, and you might, he's a super great guy, Thomas Moser. He actually is on the board of the Swiss National Bank.
Mm-hmm.
But he is a wonderful guy, and he came to me. And he said, David, I want to make eCash great again.
Okay.
And I said, okay, Thomas, I'll help you. And so we worked on it. And so we created eCash 2.0.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well,
Is it the Project Turbulent?
Yeah, exactly. Because that's mm-hmm. half paid for by the Swiss National, or not exactly half, but roughly joint
Swiss
venture
Central
and
Bank.
The Bank for International Settlement.
Uh-huh. And, actually,
and they built it.
And
yeah.
Actually, I was really curious about this project in particular because you've been advocating for online privacy for many years. And in this case, it's like privacy tool. If we're talking about like doing transactions online, you definitely, they have to be private so you
right.
feel secure. But when we're talking about CBDCs, they're lacking very important, let's say pillar, if we're talking about people who are in favor of decentralization,
yeah.
they are lacking decentralization. So in this case, when we're talking about CBDCs, we cannot say 100% that they are private. Is that correct? So please tell
that's
me how...
That's not exactly correct.
Okay.
I can tell you that,
yeah, yeah. So,
that it's
like,
a really interesting thing. Sure,
question.
Please. Yeah.
So, yeah, you know,
no,
I'm really curious. I would like to
I
know
understand.
That if we're talking about CBDC, and this, for me, it's a really interesting project that you've been also mentioning earlier at some conferences in the UAE in particular. But doesn't this project, how does it protect users' privacy if we're talking about central
right.
bank digital currency, CBDC in this case?
Yes. So like we have there's a kind of American expression we say, I get this all the time,
Okay.
People ask me, I was at the Satoshi Roundtable
yeah.
here in Dubai
uh-huh.
A little while ago. And, there were a lot of people meeting
mm-hmm.
about CBDC. It was like a big group, maybe 30 people. And
because
one of my friends said, David, just don't go there. Go around that.
Uh-huh.
Don't let them see you because they are hostile to CBDC. And I understand that. And, people in... So when the European Central Bank put out a public call for comments about CBDC some years ago, it's very well known that 40% of the responses were about privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you look at the difference between what we hope to have in the West and what some major countries in the East have, this privacy thing is a big differentiator.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so and generally advocates, you join a movement. It's you are encouraged by your co-advocates, and usually you kind of paint the bad guys with a pretty wide brush. You know, it's like they're all rotten. You know, and we were against anything like that. You know, and then your buddies say, yeah, and I understand that, but I did something with CBDC very deliberately, mm-hmm. and now it's had a very funny consequence, which I'll explain in a moment. But I was afraid that governments would say, you know, we'd like to have privacy in our CBDC, of course, mm-hmm. but we can't really have, you know, the Chomian privacy where you control your own privacy with the secrets that you created, because that would be weak. You know, maybe a quantum computer could break it, or, you know, the security wouldn't be as good as we need it to protect you because we're the government, right? Mm-hmm. And so therefore, we can't really have you protecting your own privacy. Just trust us. We'll protect your privacy, because then we'll have a really secure system. Mm-hmm. And I can easily imagine that happening. So we wouldn't get real user-controlled privacy in the West. And I think that would be the end, because even little kids know you can't really trust other people with your secrets, right? Too much, because it's going to leak out, right? Everyone knows this.
Well, it depends whom you like leaking secrets, let's say, like this.
Well, let's say, the U.S. government couldn't even keep all the information they had about all the people who applied for security clearances secret. You know that. That was all leaked. Unbelievable. Any kind of corporate database, government database, all leaked. Look at the Snowden thing. I mean, really, you know, the super secret stuff of the NSA. So it's all leaked. So it just doesn't, information wants to be free. You know, even kids know, I think, that you it wouldn't give you a warm feeling of privacy if the government said, oh, trust us with your data, right?
So
especially now. So what I wanted to do was prove irrefutably that there's absolutely no good reason to give up user-controlled privacy in order to get security in the CBDC. And the way I did that was designing eCash 2.0 so that it has better security than any system that's ever been fielded. And that is what we call unconditional or information-theoretic security. In other words, even with a quantum computer or a billion quantum computers or unlimited computing power or some kind of computers they have on Mars or we don't even know about, whatever, you know, it doesn't matter. AI, it will not help you counterfeit this money.
How?
And I can explain it very simply, if you'd like to know. Yeah,
sure.
So, well, it's something I invented like 30 years ago called fail-stop signatures.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very simple idea. So in eCash, right, I randomly create my money number.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it like a long serial number for a piece of money. And then I hash that.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have the hash image, you know, so the secret serial number, that's the pre-image, and then the hash is the image.
Mm-hmm.
And then I homomorphically encrypt that image, that hash, and I send it into the bank. And I say, okay, it's me. I want to take $100 out. Please sign this with your $100 signing key.
Mm-hmm.
So they sign it with that special key, making it worth $100, send it back. Now I can remove the homomorphic encryption, and now I have the bank's worth $100 signature on my hash image.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, but they don't know what my hash image is, and of course no one knows what my pre-image is.
Mm-hmm.
And so then later when so they can't take my money away,
mm-hmm.
and later when I want to spend it, I say, okay, here's the hash image and here's the signature on it. And people say, that's great, but, you know, we got to check to see if it's already been spent,
mm-hmm.
right? So they look on the spent coin list, they know it's not on that list yet. We'll put it on there, but David, you have to prove that you have the pre-image. And so I say, okay, fine. I'm going to reveal the pre-image to you, but first, just give me a signature back saying if you show us the pre-image to this hash, we're, you know, you get the $100 mm-hmm. right now. It's not on the spent coin list.
Yeah.
So once I get that signature, I reveal the pre-image, and now the payment is final. So it's a beautiful, perfect system. That's the original eCash 1.0. Now, eCash 2.0 improves on that,
mm-hmm.
and it actually leads to better than money. It's kind of interesting. Now, how it does it is to get to the unconditional protection against counterfeiting uh-huh. is very simple. That hash function is not what you might think. It just doesn't take, let's say, a 1,000-bit pre-image secret into a 1,000-bit hash image.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a, let's say, 1,200-bit pre-image into a 1,000-bit hash image. So there's an extra 200 bits on the input.
Okay.
That means that on average, there's 2 to the 200 inputs that would create that same output.
Mm-hmm.
So bear with me, Maria, just for a second, right?
Yeah.
So what that means is that even if with super intelligence, Martians, unlimited computing power, you can stare at that hash image all day long, and you will never be able to guess my secret input, my pre-image. So you will have to try to spend the money,
uh-huh.
and then I will say, hey, wait a minute, that's money, my money, right? Here's my pre-image.
Uh-huh.
It will differ from yours
mm-hmm.
with unbelievably high probability, right? But in the hash function world, if you ever show two pre-images for the same image, we call that a claw. It means the system's broken.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very short proof that the whole hash system is broken. So that's what a fail stop signature does. You mm-hmm. see, with the original eCash 1.0, you know, people might be counterfeiting it, and you might think, well, there's a lot more money being spent here than we issue, but we're not really sure because we're not sure how long people are holding it before they spend it.
Mm-hmm.
And before you know it, you know, there's a lot of counterfeiting that's happening. You never really can say, okay, we're stopping this, you know, because you have no proof. But with eCash 2.0, as soon as the first notes are counterfeit, boom, there's an irrefutable proof and you stop. So that's why we can say it's a super secure against counterfeiting.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's an additional aspect, which I'm going to mention real briefly, because we talked about mixing, right? So what is mixing? It's a very simple idea. You know, when you play cards sitting around the table, you shuffle, then you give the cards to the person on your left, they
mm-hmm.
shuffle and so on. It goes around the table. You know, maybe some people don't really shuffle. They pretend to shuffle, but they don't really. It doesn't matter. If even one person in there really shuffles good, then by the time it gets all the way around, it's fully shuffled, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea of mixing. You know, I take this hash image, and I encrypt it in a special way, send it into the mix network. A lot of other people do. The first node in the network shuffles them, changes the encryption a little bit, sends it to the next node. They shuffle, change the encryption a little, and send it along. Now, if any one of those nodes is honest, then no one can tell which input corresponds with which output.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you don't have to know which one is honest, just if there is any one. So this is what we do in, XX Network that I founded, which is a super great system. If you don't know about it, you should familiarize yourself with it. But so with XX Network, you know, you send the messages in and they get mixed and sent around and around the world and mixed and sent. So in eCash 2.0,
mm-hmm.
when you get your image signed under the homomorphic encryption, you also take another version of it and you encrypt it for mixing, and it gets mixed and ends up being published. So instead of a list of already spent numbers
mm-hmm.
that prevents double spending, we have now a list of ready to spend numbers that doesn't grow. It's just the numbers that are ready. You can't spend it unless it's on that list.
Mm-hmm.
And so The only way to cheat is to find a number on that list and then figure out a pre-image for it and try to spend it. But that's what I showed you. Mm-hmm. Even with infinite computing power, you can't get away with that.
Even with quantum,
yeah. I don't care what kind of quantum computers, you know, Martian computers, unlimited, doesn't matter. Uh-huh. No matter what you do, you can stare at that hash forever. You're never going to be able to make a better guess than a random guess as to which random number I chose that created it. Mm-hmm. And if you guess different from what I chose, then I just prove that you're cheating by showing my pre-image. Mm-hmm. And boom, we call that a concise proof of counterfeiting. Mm-hmm. So that means the system's broken.
You know, from this perspective, I will be following this closely because I'm really curious when we're talking about initially about quantum computers, how it will be developing over the years, because obviously right now they cannot operate under normal circumstances. So it'll be really interesting actually to look at, like, let's say in 5 years, what will be happening.
Well, let me just real quick just mm-hmm. say this, that the history of cryptography since the Second World War has been that the U.S. government has repeatedly, mm-hmm. from the very beginning, over and over again, promulgated cryptographic systems that they knew how to break. Mm-hmm. From the very first days, they gave out cryptographic equipment after the war to their mm-hmm. allies, but they already knew how to break it. Mm-hmm. And this has happened over and over again. They bought these Swiss companies and operated them as if they were Swiss companies. Mm-hmm. They were selling breakable crypto. I broke that crypto. I can tell you it's breakable. I did it for, with a white hat on, you know, to help a major company decide what
to use.
Which
ones? I broke both
Crypto AG,
okay.
which is irrefutably a CIA and BND, the German Secret Service, proprietary company that was selling cryptographic equipment to all kinds of countries. It's the leading exporter of cryptographic equipment for military and diplomatic use globally. Mm-hmm. It was being run by the CIA, by the NSA and the BND, and I broke it. And the Swiss, this is now in the newspapers in Switzerland, and the Swiss are really, really mad because it, you know, made them look really bad that this was run by the U.S. government secretly. Mm-hmm. And then there's another second company, not in Zug, but also in near Zurich, was called Greytag. Mm-hmm. And funny thing is, Greytag made those giant projectors that I was talking about for the video projection, mm-hmm. you know, with those giant, like three big lenses, remember yeah. those big things? But Greytag made the Greytag coder, which was used by Swift. Mm-hmm. And I broke it. I broke it on a single flip chart. I showed them how to break it on one, remember what a flip chart is? Just one flip chart. And I used what's called differential cryptanalysis before it was public. So it freaked them out. And then, you know, they had to
what
pay me
after?
To fix it. They had to pay me to fix it. Uh-huh. But it means that the U.S. government could watch all high-value money transfers in the world up until that point, at least. And they could inject them too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it has happened that people walked out of De Beers with $50 million packet of uncut diamonds mm-hmm. that was paid for by a Swift transfer mm-hmm. and later it turned out to be fraudulent. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, who knows what all happened with that, you know, but I wasn't involved in any criminal activity, but I'm just saying, And that same Greytag coder was also like camo colored, mm-hmm. sold to a lot of countries around the world for military use and diplomatic use. So I'm just trying to say that, you know, and the NSA was caught, you know, bribing the RSA security company mm-hmm. with $10 million to put a backdoor in the random number generator that they had, and over and over and over again. So now the U.S. government is saying, oh, you know, we're worried about quantum computers. Use these new quantum safe algorithms that we're proposing here. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about, you know, the man behind the curtain, right? Just use these. It's public, whatever. And so, like, big companies are like, oh, great. Everyone's going to have to change all their cryptography. We can make a lot of money selling them new stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But the truth is that those quantum safe algorithms are probably breakable without even having a quantum computer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or if you need a quantum computer to break them, you can be sure that the U.S. government already has one in their lab. You know, there are photographs of cryogenic, super cooled computers being, rolled into the NSA in the 60s. I mean, the Joseph Junction, they are very ahead. You know, these guys have more money than God. They can do whatever they want. So to think that they're going to tell you how to use, make codes that they can't break, you got to be smoking something. You know, really, come on, please. It's over and over again. Look at the Snowden revelations. Now, these are the guys that intercept the routers in the FedEx system, switch the chips. You know, they'll do anything to break everything. And it's unbelievable. They've been able to break everything. And, if you have that much money and that many dedicated people and so quantum, the whole quantum safe thing is a hoax to just keep on letting governments break stuff. But what I'm talking about is not quantum safe. It's unconditionally secure. It's the real deal. It's the same mm-hmm. thing I was talking about in the 80s for privacy protection. So, mm-hmm. It gets me a little riled up. Sorry.
Yeah.
But, I just can't believe it. It's just people have such a short memory. They forget this. It's you see it over and over again.
Encrypted is your exclusive ticket to the epicenter of technological innovations in the MENA region.
I would like to, again, address one of the pieces that you've written about particular risks of data accumulation in light of artificial intelligence.
Yes.
And that we could never know what AI can do with this information. So is there still a path that you believe that people can actually get control for that people can only... that AI can bring some benefits to the world, everyone, and we can still have control over that, not only like some, let's say, only like certain people, but
Everybody. Can
AI, let's say, be decentralized as well? That's one of the very interesting things that I'm asking quite a lot of people, that they have very different views on that.
Well, it's definitely an interesting line of inquiry. And I have written a little book about this, which is not yet
been published.
And
okay, so we can actually talk about this.
I can't I don't want to spoil it, but if you read it...
Just a teaser.
You'll find that it's a very optimistic scenario for the world. So in a sense, privacy technology is the key element. And people can, if the public... I developed this thing called sample voting, except for the state. It's guerrilla democracy. You can mm-hmm. prove that a majority of a population support a particular issue with just for like $1,000 just by sending some letters. So with that, if we can catalyze a social movement to cool the planet mm-hmm. through the astrocool technology, then people will be pulled together believing they control. They have the power and are making the world a better place. And that can lead to a much more democratic form in which AI can be, it's called AI Keto. The idea is like it's a martial arts move. You can turn AI mm-hmm. On itself. You can use its power to protect you so people can use AIs to... individually to protect society, and we can basically harness the power of AI to make sure that people are in control. You know, Elon Musk said not that long ago, AI can do any job. Mm-hmm. Any job that anyone has could be done by AI. But he's definitely wrong, because the one job that AI certainly cannot do is to represent humans and, against AI. You have to vote as a person, to protect the rights of people mm-hmm. against AI. And that's you cannot give that job to an AI. And that's what AI Keto and my work, is really aimed at, is empowering people to have the last word on all kinds of decisions that shape society through this sample voting technology. And if you're interested, write to me and I'm happy to tell you a bit more about it. But that, I have a vision for how that can all happen. But, you know, I think that the better the money is a more urgent mm-hmm. proposition to spread the meme that you can control your own privacy and to enrich, you know, or at least create the opportunity for the global poor to enrich themselves and to avoid a global liquidity crisis, which will be devastating. And people in the know in the financial system realize that the current structures are not robust against this, right? You realize that, you know, Silicon Valley Bank and GameStop was just very easily done by a few people sending a few social media messages, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have a robust financial system. It may very well be brought to collapse just because people can organize a little more effectively than back in the paper-based only world. So we have to, you know, increase global prosperity in a way that people are motivated mm-hmm. to empower, you know, capital and democracy mm-hmm. and protect society from AI. And I have, mm-hmm. you know, been working for 40 years to help, you know, move this idea forward. And now we're in critical endgame, and the smartphone is, you know, it's really created, this is it. AI has now hit the public's attention, you know, but AI is like cryptanalysis. Don't forget that. You know, we don't really know who is doing what with AI, and it's all, you know, a lot of it's behind the scenes. So, you know, recently we heard a big controversy about maybe there was a big breakthrough, but it wasn't disclosed to the public. You know, someone, I don't know if you've noticed that about, you know, the recent. So it's, you know, this is it, people. It's endgame.
So today we had David Chow, famous computer scientist, founder of DigiCash, and godfather of cryptocurrency. Right now we're moving to our rapid-fire questions. Stay tuned. Rapid-fire questions. So David, right now we will have rapid-fire questions round. I will ask you to answer like one or two probably words or one sentence really quick.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. If you had to explain eCash to a child, how would you do this in one sentence?
It's a peg note where you create the serial number yourself and no one can see it until you spend it.
Name five qualities that you believe a real entrepreneur should have.
Oh, passion, leadership, passion, and inventiveness.
Okay, what would you never do while building a company?
Be unnecessarily unkind to anyone.
Okay, Bitcoin or Ethereum?
Bitcoin.
What's your favorite programming language?
Well, I wrote the first blockchain in Settle.
Uh-huh.
It's, yeah.
Amazing. The moment that you're the most proud of in your career?
When I decided to double down on Better Than Money.
Okay. My business philosophy is?
Well, I like to have an unfair advantage.
Uh-huh. If you could time travel, which era would you go to? Which era would you like to visit?
The future one that I envision.
Okay, interesting. What time?
Well, maybe...
Which decade, probably?
Maybe 30, 40 years out.
Interesting. If there were a movie about your life, how would you call it?
It's hard to change the world, but it's possible.
Interesting. The next big trend for everyone to follow?
Better than money.
Interesting. And what is your personal formula for success?
Well, you really have to selflessly work hard. That's what I do.
Thank you. And Dubai for you is associated with? Our major question, the last question we were asking all the time. Dubai for you is associated with, David?
I really like Dubai. I think I could see living here. It's a fabulous...
So you can see like next home.
Okay, it's Dubai, next home.
Okay, thank you. Today we had David Chow, famous computer scientist, founder of DigiCash, and at the same time right now, the founder of Better Than Money. Thank you for watching and see you next time.
From the gleaming skyscrapers of Dubai to the innovation hubs of the Middle East and beyond, Encrypted brings you thought-provoking discussions, exclusive insights, and stories of innovation that will leave you inspired.